We are going to go ahead and get started. Please continue to eat your lunches. We have a full program, though, so we do want to begin on time so that we can end on time. This is our program on the Employee Free Choice Act, posing the question, who benefits? This is a program that focuses on a piece of legislation for which I understand there's at least been a threatened filibuster or talk of a filibuster in the Senate, and there's been a promise, I suppose, of a veto by the administration. So nothing controversial about what we'll be discussing today. My job is to be quick and get out of the way, so let me introduce our moderator for today's program. He is John Irving. He's a former general counsel to the NLRB up until 1979, at which time he started work for Kirkland & Ellis, where he is a partner today. Importantly for our purposes, he is a member of the executive committee of our Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, the sponsor of today's program at the Federalist Society. So without anything further, John.
Thank you, Dean.
Thank you. You're very kind. Thank you. And I'll get right to the point, too, because we'll do a quick job of introducing our speakers, who we're very grateful to have today, and then maybe say a couple of words about the format, and we'll get right on with it. We've had 90 minutes. We have almost 90 minutes. So let me just say that we thank all of you for coming today. And I noticed that we have a number of board people here, which is good. We have former board member. We have present board member Liebman and Peter Schomber and member Kirtenau. And we have former member Bob Brame. And on the program, of course, we have former board member Fox and John Rodabaugh. So let me just quickly introduce. Well, let me say how we're going to take this. Basically, we'll break this down into three general subject headings that we'll deal with each of them. The first one has to do with the card check provisions of H.R. 800. The second one we'll talk about is the, and actually the second and the third one will combine, the mandatory arbitration provisions of the bill, and then the penalties and souped-up remedy sections of the bill. So, and what we'll deal with each of those. So, I think we'll start off with former board member Sarah Fox. I believe you'll go first. If that,
actually, I
unless
think
you've
we,
rejuggled.
We have a substitution,
right.
So we're going to start with Brian.
Let me just introduce each one of the speakers, then we won't have to do it later on. I'll start with Brian Kennedy, who we are very fortunate to have today. He learned that he was coming about an hour and a half, 2 hours ago, because Brent Guerin had trouble getting back yesterday to his office from Hawaii, as did I, and couldn't make it today, but we have a good substitute for him, Brian Kennedy, who is presently the general counsel to the Committee on Education and Labor, University of Virginia Law School, and also from that side, shall we say, we have Sarah Fox, a former NLRB member, Yale undergraduate, Harvard Law School, and presently with Brett Hoffenkaiser in Washington. We have John Rodabaugh, former board member, and presently with partner at Baker & McKenzie in Chicago, who has testified on the bill. And then we also have Charlotte Montiel from Vanderbilt University, who is presently the deputy director of the Senate Republican Steering Committee. So with that, what we'll do then is get started right into the substance of our program today. And as indicated, Brian will start. And then I guess then we'll go, John, with you. And then we'll go with you, Sarah. And then we'll go with you, Charlotte. Okay?
And how much time should we each take at this point?
I mean, the idea would be each take about 8 minutes and maybe 7 minutes because we're starting a little bit late. And we need to save 15 minutes on each subject for questions and answers.
Well, thank you. My name is Brian Kennedy, and I'm general counsel for the House Committee on Education and Labor. And we were very pleased to be able to get 241 votes to pass the Employee Free Choice Act, including 8 Republicans, and it's our hope that it'll someday become law. I'm going to focus my comments on what we call the majority sign-up portion of the bill and talk about what the law is now, how the bill would change that, and why we think that change is needed. Under current law, there are essentially two ways that a union can be organized. The employees can either, 30% of them, sign authorization cards requesting an NLRB election, or a majority can sign up and present them to the employer, and then the employer can choose to recognize the union. Under current law, the employer also has the option of choosing to essentially veto the employee's choice and require that there be an election. Now, it's our view that current law is skewed in favor of those who oppose union organizing. And I think probably the best evidence of that is that in 2005, 31,000 employees were received back pay because of illegal employer activities. Right now, in organizing campaigns, it's the regular course of business. I think about 3/4 of employers hire union busting or union avoidance firms. They require employees to attend one-on-one meetings with their supervisors with the purpose of that to ascertain how the employee feels about joining the union and convincing them not to. They also have captive audience meetings with employees on work time where employees have to sit down and hear the employer's anti-union campaign. And on the other side of that, the union has very little access to employees. They either have to stand outside of the employer's property near the fence and pass out flyers, or somehow encourage employees to either let them in their homes or to meet at third-party locations to present their case. So we think the current system is very unfair. We think that the fact that 31,000 employees receive back pay is an indication that the current penalties are not really doing the job. And so we believe that this legislation is needed. And I guess as part of my time, I want to address what I think are two red herring arguments that are often raised against the legislation. One is that it gets rid of the private or the secret ballot. It doesn't do that. It would still allow 30% of the employees to choose to go through that process in order to organize. What it does do is get rid of the employer's ability to veto the choice of the employees through the card authorization. Secondly, an argument is raised that that we are allowing card signatures to serve the purpose of certifying a union, but we're not allowing it for the purpose of decertifying a union. The fact of the matter is, under current law, it's very easy to get rid of a union. If a majority of the employees signed cards indicating they didn't support the union, the employer would not only be allowed to refuse to recognize the union at that point, but the employer actually has an obligation to refuse to recognize the union after they have evidence that a majority of the employees no longer support the union. So I guess with that, I'll pass it on.
Good afternoon. Remembering something I learned from my years in Atlanta, to Virginia graduates, but what I just heard is summarized in the South as that dog don't hunt. And big time. Let me read some remarks first before I address the red herrings. In 1953, organized labor represented 1/3 of the workforce. Labor's slide to 7.4% did not occur this year, last year, or with this administration. Failure is due to many factors: a changing workplace, different work, new technologies, generational changes, a host of events, even including human and institutional failure, corruption, fraud, ignorance, and more. But fact, not opinion, and certainly not interest group paid for research, must come to the surface, and we must base any ultimate decision on what is true. Truth must prevail. For example, at the beginning, any means of gathering majority status could be certified. In only 4 years, in 1939, the Labor Board recognized the inherent qualitative differences between registering choice by secret ballot or by public observation and limited the benefit of certification to board-conducted secret ballot elections only. Or how about this fact? In fiscal year 2005, unions won 60.4% of RC and RM elections conducted by the board. Or inflexibilities and high costs in collective bargaining agreements, in collective contracts, in union-dense industrial sectors have been hit hard. Auto, steel, and airline industries. Or how about this fact? Our federal law requires union officers to be elected by secret ballot. Or this one. The AFL argued for and got the Labor Board to require secret ballot elections to decertify to get rid of the union representative, and it's not a red herring, and we can debate that later. Some corporate executives are in prison. So, too, are some union leaders. Some pension plans are grossly underfunded. Mr. Sweeney touts union benefits but pushes his party for taxpayer-funded health care. The U.S. auto industry, union and management, plead for tariffs, trade barriers, and taxpayer-paid bailouts for relief from what, in large part, is their own inability historically over decades to control costs and just say no to absurd demands. Congressman Miller endorsed the secret ballot for Mexico's workers. He received a reported 63.7% of his PAC money from labor. And he coordinates his white papers with the AFL, pejoratively describing the U.S. labor law as administered by the federal agency, the National Labor Relations Board, with war rhetoric. I've had enough. I've had enough. Organized Labor's party identifies problems: administrative delay, unit gerrymandering, weak or non-existent remedies. But this has nothing to do with the mechanism of registering choice, the secret ballot. What the union and its party are attempting to do is prevent employees from hearing the rest of the story. And it's gone on since 1935 and before. We've heard it over and over and over. To make a free choice, you know and I know that you need to be informed. Why are you going to join one country club over another? Why do you go to one particular church or synagogue or mosque versus another? Why do you go to one store over another? You've got to have information. And you must register that choice free of any pressure. I'm not talking with a gun at the forehead. I'm talking about, excuse me, but would you look that way while I sign my preference? I don't want to be seen. I shouldn't have to be observed. This bill eliminates both critical elements. Card check is almost always by stealth for the very purpose of not attracting attention that would release counter-information. Signing a card in front of the union organizer, even without threat or coercion, is not without peer pressure. This bill provides no limit on the length of the union stealth campaign, no limit at all. No notice of the inception of the campaign, no avenue to incent information to come forward to help educate the person who's supposed to decide between yes or no. Yes, I want to be represented, or no, I don't. How much does it cost? What are the advantages? What has your success been in other industries? And so forth. If the union's party finds the labor board's laboratory conditions to have failed, then I say their push for lavatory conditions is unacceptable. The search for truth must extend beyond attention-grabbing hearings with always 3 out of 4 from the majority party, whether it's Republicans or Democrats. And don't base the legislative debate on so-called academic studies, often from my graduate school, paid for by the very interest groups using the resulting study as their data, and the database coming from members of the paying client. Let's start over. This has a lot more to do with a naive notion of what legislative processes should be about, the truth. Let the Congressional Research Service or a bipartisan commission study the alleged shortcomings. In the end, let's fix what's broken. It may be that the union message is stale or that something new is required, but trashing the mechanism, the secret ballot, when your real intention is to deprive the workplace electorate of the facts is wrong, and you know it, and if you don't, your mother would have told you so. Thank you.
Sarah, you're going to take over. You can sharpen your views on this bill later when we have questions.
Okay.
Just a couple of facts just that I think would be helpful. Representation petitions last year, first election, initial representation, were down considerably, 25.6% down from the year before. 3,643 petitions were filed. Those went to an election, in most cases, 91.1% of those elections were conducted pursuant to election agreements where the employer and the union agree and you go to a election to which both consent. And that 94.2% of those elections were conducted in 56 days. So the election petitions are down, and the largest significant number of elections are processed and conducted very quickly. Sarah?
I guess I'll just, I think I'm just going to sort of try to address some of the specific points that have been made, and I guess I'd just start by making a comment about the election petition process and the statistics that John Irving just cited about the election numbers being down. I think the reason why the numbers are down is that organized labor increasingly just seeks to avoid the NLRB election process because they regard it as so one-sided, and that an increasing number of workers are being organized through a means which has always been lawful under the National Labor Relations Act, that is voluntary recognition by an employer based on a showing of majority support, such as signed cards. So I don't know that those statistics necessarily reflect a decrease in organizing activity. I think I would just also comment in response to the John Rodabaugh statement about the decline in union representation, and I certainly agree that there are many, many things contributing to the decline in the number of people who are represented by unions that go far beyond this particular representation process. But it is always interesting to me that if, in fact, employers do believe that it's because workers don't want unions, I don't know why they spend billions of dollars on the union avoidance industry. And all you need to do is to, put in union avoidance into Google and look at the websites that come up to see what kind of a business this is. And I do think that union avoidance industry and what it encourages in terms of employer behavior does have a significant, although hardly a determinative, impact on the percentage of the workforce that is organized. To talk a little bit about history here, the National Labor Relations Act was passed to promote democracy in the workplace. And we often hear that cited in connection with the defense of the current process, that the secret ballot election is what Congress was promoting. In fact, what Congress meant by democracy in the workplace, what Senator Wagner and the others who passed the act was workers through their own representatives engaging in collective bargaining with their employers. The notion that the purpose of the act was to have some process where at the end of the day, a board agent came into the workplace with a cardboard box and had an election, that was the democracy in the workplace that the act was supposed to promote is just not true. In fact, the current situation where the employer is able to effectively insist on an secret ballot election is a relatively recent innovation in board history and one that is entirely created by the board and the courts. Up until the late 60s, and even after and through the passage of the 1947, the Taft-Hartley Act, it was the law that an employer, upon being presented with evidence that a majority of his workers supported a union, was required to recognize and bargain with the union. And it was not until the late 60s that the board adopted a new policy, subsequently upheld by the Supreme Court in the early 70s in the Linden Lumber case, which allowed employers to, for whatever reason, simply refuse, even if they had no basis whatsoever to doubt the existence of a majority, to nevertheless refuse to recognize and force the union to file a petition. So again, I think this notion that people try to give that somehow from the earliest days of the act, the secret ballot was the centerpiece of the National Labor Relations Act is simply historically inaccurate. Even after Linden Lumber, it has remained, as Brian said, very much part of the law that it is perfectly lawful for an employer to recognize a union based on evidence such as cards. And the card collection process is part of every, including NLRB election, because in order to invoke the mechanisms of the board, the union must make a showing of support from at least 30% of the workers, and that showing is made and can only be made by the union going around and collecting cards. So the idea that there is something inherently undemocratic about cards, the idea that getting people, that when you're organizing a union, just like when you're organizing any other kind of organization in which is a membership organization in which people participate, that you do it by going face-to-face to the people that you're trying to get to join your organization and asking them to join your organization is a completely normal process. We see it every day in every other kind of organization that we have. So the notion that somehow one worker asking another worker to sign up for an organization that they are trying to form in their workplace is inherently undemocratic or inherently contrary to what the National Labor Relations Act was intended to promote is, I think, ludicrous. The act is about promoting self-organization, and self-organization means workers among themselves getting together and deciding whether or not they want to deal with their employer on an individual basis or on a collective basis. The focus that has come to pass on this process and the gauntlet that workers are made to go through in order to get a union is, again, as I say, a relatively recent innovation, and it is something that doesn't make a lot of sense in the overall scheme of things. There are millions and millions and millions of workers in this country who have unions who did not get their union by going through a secret ballot election. They got their union because they went to work in an organized workplace. And nobody suggests that because of that, because they didn't get to go into a booth and, you know, a board election booth and vote on whether they wanted a union, that somehow they've been forced into a union or they're under some kind of, you know, compulsion. The fact of the matter is that it is relatively easy for workers if they don't want their union to get rid of it. And ironically, one way they can get rid of their union is to sign a petition. and present it to the employer. And as Brian says, that an employer can ignore such a petition at his peril. He cannot simply refuse to do anything in the face of evidence that kind of evidence. And in those contexts, whether it's the employer voluntarily recognizing the union or the employer withdrawing recognition because he's been presented with signed cards or a petition by his employer, the board and the courts never question whether or not that evidence is adequate to demonstrate the true wishes of the employer. It is only in the context of this where the employers are seeking to, you know, in this where they're trying to use that same mechanism and make the choice themselves rather than make it be their choice rather than the employer, that somehow people are suddenly raising this notion that cards are inherently untrustworthy. And I think there's just a lot of hypocrisy that goes on around this. And I think a lot of mythology. And I was on the board, and I think there's an institutional belief in the election process that I think is somewhat unthinking. There's a lot of rhetoric around it. There's these kind of somewhat absurd terms that are used. The board says that elections are conducted under laboratory conditions, whatever that is, as if this was all a big science experiment. But the rhetoric around it, I think, has blinded, I think, the institution somewhat to the reality of what it is like for a worker to be subject to that intense pressure from their employer to renege and to revoke a choice they've made to support a union. And it's something that we recognize in other contexts of the law, that the nature of the relationship between workers and employers, and I'm not talking even about illegal conduct, but that the nature of the relationship is such that things that would not be coercive if they occurred peer-to-peer or if they occurred between people outside that relationship are. And the prime example of where we recognize that is in the law of sexual harassment. We recognize that when your employer asks you out on a date, that is not your supervisor asks you for sexual favors. That's not the same as a coworker doing that. That's not the same as somebody that you meet in a bar. And the fact of the matter is that in a union organizing campaign, the kind of pressure that employers are able to exert within this closed world that the employer controls is inherently coercive, and that all that the Employee Free Choice Act is trying to do is not to, and I think that it's important to note that one of the reasons why the law has developed the way it is because there has been recognition that employers have rights to free speech, and it's very difficult to regulate speech. It's recognized that employers have property rights, and that there's a reluctance on the part of the government to be too intrusive on the employer's property. This act doesn't seek to try to do something intrusive that would either cut back on employer speech or force the government into the workplace to monitor what goes on a day-to-day basis. It simply tries to, the employer is free to campaign. The employer can campaign from the day that worker is hired about how he feels about unions. And believe me, employers do. Employers are free to make their views known at any point in any way, and after all, they are demonstrating to their employees every day what life is like in their workplace without a union. That's different from saying that you ought to have some period of time after employees have made a decision among themselves that they want a union, where those employees are subjected to an intense period of pressure from their employer to revoke the choice that they've already made. And that's all that the Employee Free Choice Act does. So I can respond a little more later.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. It's always fun going last because you have so much to talk about. Sarah makes up a good point when she says that that one process might not be inherently unfair and the other one might be inherently unfair or not fair or so forth. But that doesn't mean that there's not a better system. I mean, just because one isn't totally evil doesn't mean that it might not be subject to more flaws than another. private elections came about for a reason, and that's because of worker intimidation. They guarantee democratic self-determination in that it's the fairest way to guarantee rights of workers to freely choose whether they want to be represented by a union or not. And they also make sure that there's election integrity. The card check system can exclude workers. All you need is 50% plus one of people to sign cards to certify a union. That means that the other workers might not even know that this campaign is going on until the union is actually certified. Jen Jason went before Brian's committee and gave a great testimony about her experiences as a former union organizer. And she says, quote, "The number of cards that were signed had less to do with support for the union and more to do with the effectiveness of the organizer speaking to the workers." You know, we've been kind of getting into the nitty-gritty of card check versus secret ballot and so forth. But if we just step back and think about it, what can happen in this card check system? And just practically speaking, what happens? She tells us. They have a process called house calling, where a couple of organizers will go door to door and talk to employees about this card check system. How do they get the addresses? Well, they can, as she stated, look at the cars in the parking lots of the workplaces, jot down the license plate numbers, and then do a reverse address check to get the addresses. And this is how they find the employees. So Brian's assertion that they have very little access to employees is a bit overstated, considering they make access. Jason goes forward with her testimony and says that they were basically trained to agitate employees to sign these cards. And she says very openly that these people were signing cards oftentimes because she was getting them riled up and emotional, and they just wanted them out of their house or to stop bothering them in the parking lot or so forth. And it wasn't necessarily an educated or conscious decision. In fact, she even tells us that that some workers would come back and ask for their cards back and say, you know, I was kind of emotional. I didn't really want to sign that card. Can I have it back? And her union made it a policy not to give the cards back or to destroy the cards. Now, I know there are a bunch of union people in this room, and different unions have different policies, so I can't speak for all. But that was the experience that she had, and it's one that we need to be cognizant of when we're talking about union policy. And then I think I would be remiss, being one of the political agents in the room, if I didn't talk about the politics involved in this bill. This bill has a lot to do with getting more money to unions. Union membership is on the decline. It's down 12% nationwide, and just 7% of the private sector is unionized. In 2006, union membership declined by 326,000 members. So this basically makes sure that because there are statistics about how card check is a better form for getting people to join unions than private elections are, it ensures a more probable possibility that we can get more union members, thus more union dues and more money to the unions. And then just to respond to some of the other comments that people have made, Sarah brought the interesting point that we see it every day in other organizations where we have peer-to-peer, you know, coming, hey, do you want to join this organization? Do you want to do this? But I don't think that's necessarily fair to put a union on the same level as the PTA. I mean, this isn't like something where you drop by a meeting every once in a while and you can go or not go. These are dues coming out of your paycheck, and it's a bit more complicated to get out of that union, especially if you're not in a right-to-work state. You know, millions of people do get unionized through card check, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's the best process, and it doesn't necessarily mean it should be mandated for all members to go through this. She also encouraged you to look back at Jen Jason's testimony about the peer-to-peer coercion that can happen. I mean, she says flat out that her experience with peers coming to try to get her to join a union made her work experience miserable, that it became such a divisive issue among all the workers that it became a hard working environment. So, and in fact, the peer-to-peer coercion is not something that we can just kind of gloss over. It's going to happen whether you have secret ballots or whether you have card checks. But with secret ballots, nobody knows how you're voting. You can be comfortable and confident that you can make a decision on your own and not have to be harassed about it by either, you know, unions or your employer or other peers. You know, if we really care about workers, we want to make sure that they can make a choice that they feel like is best for them, that's educated, and they can only make that choice if the employers know what's happening. Oftentimes with this card check system, the employer can be left out of the process. They're, you know, a union shows up with 50% plus one card checks already signed, and they haven't had a chance to educate their workers. Now, I guess they could every day, you know, go ahead and be doing that, like Sarah mentioned, but it's probably not something that, it's probably not the big focus until you actually have a campaign process going forth.
Okay, thank you.
And I think what we'll do now is throw things open to some questions from the floor. But before we do that, a couple of points. Some things are difficult to reconcile. Now we do hear that management can conduct captive audience speeches, and that's true. But on the other side, it's not the same coin, but a different coin. The unions can make promises during a campaign that an employer can't make. We hear that unions avoid elections and seek card check recognition voluntarily from employers, and yet that would tend to indicate that there is more and more union membership, but there really isn't. Union membership is down to 7.4% of the private sector workforce and has not increased a single year since 1984. We hear that, employers are inclined to violate the act and so on, but just in the last year, unfair labor practice charges are down 6.7%, and in the last 10 years, they're down 31% in the last 10 years. So, I mean, what we're really talking about here is a very fundamental kind of adjustment to the representational process that is, an abrupt departure from the way things have been really since, by and large, since 1935. So, what we'll do now is, rather than give speakers another opportunity because we're running short on time, let's get right into some questions and maybe we can fill both purposes at the same time. Right.
Mr. Kennedy, you threw out the number 31,000 back pay awards, I think you said in 1 year. Isn't it true that that's all back pay awards in all types of cases, not solely back pay awards in organizing cases? And John, you might want to speak to that.
It's
number.
Back pay awards for wrongful activity by employers.
In all kinds of cases.
Right.
Yeah, and on that, I guess I can get my two cents in here, too, now and then. But
you're the moderator.
You know, on the on back pay, I mean, those figures are really deceptive, because a lot of the back pay that's collected by the agency is due to the settlement of unfair labor practice cases. When unfair labor practice cases are brought, charges brought, it's investigated. You know, a third of those cases are thrown out for lack of merit, and a third of them are withdrawn. And the large percentage of those cases as to which merit is found, which is approximately another third, about 90% of them are settled. Those are settled by employers. I mean, I have had a fair amount of experience with this, simply because they don't want to underwrite the cost of having to litigate some 8A3 cases, which can be hugely expensive. And so, with 90% of the cases settled, they're settled generally probably in 90% of those cases with what they call non-admissions clauses, where they are settled for convenience and not because it has been found that the employer has violated the law. So,
well, I mean, can I add? It's nice to have a neutral moderator. But let me.
Nobody has ever said that about me.
Let me add that these back pay awards are less whatever you make in the meantime. So the actual average award is about $3,000, which is not much incentive for an employer to not do that if they want to stop a union drive. I mean, workers are literally risking their jobs if they want to join a union, and employers are risking $3,000 fines. So it's a big difference.
But that back pay is not pursuant to any finding by the board that there has been an unfair labor practice that's been committed, except in a much smaller percentage of those cases, simply because they're settled with non-admissions clauses and before the litigation goes on, before any litigation.
I think, John, that when you were the general counsel, you would not have accepted that those were non-meritorious cases, that you were settling every single one of them, and that the only reason why the employer was, I don't think that would have been your position. Before you get to that point, there's been a merit determination by the general counsel to find reasonable cause to believe.
That is, that there's reason, right, as a prosecutorial judgment, right, that there's enough to go forward, right, to a hearing in, right, the absence of a settlement.
Right.
Any other questions?
John had a comment, I think.
I can defer to the guest and then come back.
What is 31,500 as a percentage of total payroll employment? 300 to 1%? It seems to me like that number's being thrown around as if it's a large number, but in the big scheme of things, it seems to be pretty insignificant.
It's a significant portion of the employees who are involved in union organizing campaigns on a year.
Hundredths of 1%, right?
Well, last year, the agency collected $110 million in back pay, which is, you know,
I think you'd want to compare it to the number of workers at places where there's an organizing drive going on, not payroll at large. And if you just go back a few decades, there were only 1,000 or so of these kinds of findings, so it's increasing at an amazing rate.
Let me chime in here, make one comment initially, which is when you are put through the hell of trying to get your master's thesis approved by a committee of professors in the field of econometrics, you do have to justify every source and make sure you're comparing not apples to apples, but Macintosh apples grown in a particular county at a longitude and latitude with the same grown, you know, the point. Let's get the data out and make sure we're talking about correct facts. Because this is about as useful as pointing out on a lateral arabesque that credibility of cards, Canadian experience. There's lots of articles from Canada. My non-resident, or my resident alien wife from Canada is proud of her country, but here's an article just a month old where an entire group of people were bullied into signing cards when they thought it was for a completely different purpose under the Canadian experience. Senator Wagner did not stand for anything other than this. Page 440 of Volume 1 of the legislative history, quote, "The free choice of the worker is the only thing I am interested in." And this isn't rocket science. What does it mean to make a free choice? Free and choice. How do you choose something if you don't know the benefits and costs of the choice? This is unbelievable. Unless I know the values and the costs, I can't make a choice. And what does it mean to make a choice that's free? It means I really don't think it's your business. This is like your first experience in a condo when you have to raise your hand in front of all your neighbors and vote against what they want. It brings wrath. This is what we're trying to avoid. This is not rocket science.
Maybe this is a streamlined enough process that it could be used in political elections.
Let me just say one thing about this point. You know, when Senator Wagner said the one thing that matters is employee free choice, the last thing on his mind was union coercion. What he was concerned about was employer coercion. And, you know, it really would be a distortion of history to say that kind of statement, that's what he had in mind.
Well, now I'm
older than you, but I
don't think
we were
there.
They didn't even create union unfair labor in the Wagner Act. But let me also just say, I just wanted to make one comment about the testimony you referred to from Jen Jason, who was a former HERE organizer who worked for HERE on the Cintas campaign. As she revealed at the hearing, she quit her job with HERE and got herself a $250,000 contract representing Cintas against the union, and that's the context in which she was making these statements. I have never seen anything that would verify that that's the kind of thing that goes on in union organizing campaigns other than that testimony.
Is that the same campaign where voters were identified by violating the law on copying down license plate numbers?
Well, when you don't have any other right to the information about the employees, how else is the union supposed to get access to the employees when it's not even entitled to a list of the names and addresses until after there's been a decision and direction of election?
And then there's a campaign period.
Yeah, but how do you get your showing of interest to get yourself to the point? If you have to have a showing of interest to get a board election, how do you get it when you don't have any way to have access to those employees?
All of these issues that are shortcomings should be discussed, but what does that have to do with how the person on this issue ultimately makes the choice by putting a piece of paper that they said yes or no in a booth into a box without you or me knowing how we voted? That we get off onto so many tangents. Let's take each issue one at a time. The issue here that has been the focus of the greatest mockery of my 60 years on the planet, and I say that seriously as a former naval officer, it's disgusting to think that we're on Capitol Hill, where you elect people by secret ballot, and you have laws that require voting for union officers by secret ballot, and we talk about all of this. Right now, I'm not talking about board problems, board shortcomings, anything. We're talking in this issue simply about the ultimate mechanism. What could possibly be wrong with the box? Voting in a booth and you and I don't know how you voted. What's wrong with that?
Well, I think what we ought to try to do is let's get on to our next subjects. I mean, the law does get violated. There's no question about that. I mean, there are situations where unfair labor practices,
well, can I address
where
the-
there are
the
remedies
comparison to federal elections
through the National Labor Relations Board. I mean, there are cases that are settled because the act has been truly violated. What we're talking about here, though, in this section is, you know, is it better to have car check certification as opposed to NLRB elections? Now we're going to talk about remedies and about mandatory arbitration, but before we do that, let Brian respond.
The comparison to a federal election or state election is not really a fair one. These elections are much different. These are elections where one side, the employer, who has great control and inherently has a lot of influence over employees, can have their supervisor sit down with them every day, one-on-one meetings, and one purpose of that meeting is to figure out how you're going to vote. And you have these union avoidance firms that will advertise that when you get down to an election, they'll pretty much know how everyone's going to vote. They'll follow people around. They'll go to union meetings. They'll film them. That's not the way an election is in a federal or state election. You don't have, and then you have the employees who are being fired if they exercise their right and indicate that they're going to support the union. So it's not a secret ballot like you have in a federal election campaign. It's not a free choice like you have in those kinds of campaigns.
Let's go on now, and we can come back to this if the audience is interested in asking further questions. So let's go back on to the next segment because we're going to run out of time otherwise. And what we're going to talk about here are the provisions in 800 for mandatory arbitration, which is a sea change from the kind of collective bargaining structure that we have now. And also we'll talk about the provisions for enforcement, which are markedly changed, which provide for not just discretionary but mandatory injunctions and treble damages, modifying the remedial to the table and solve their own problems and negotiate their own collective bargaining agreement. You know, it would be one thing years ago when I was in the Labor Department, George Shultz made a recommendation for changing the emergency disputes section of the Taft-Hartley Act in the situation where there's a national emergency and imposing a solution through Congress in emergency disputes. And there was mediation and there was conciliation, but the only other option was what we said was final offer selector, which means that the parties sat down and they bargained. And then finally, if they couldn't reach an agreement, and there was mediation, there's conciliation, they couldn't reach an agreement, each side would come up with its best offer. And those two offers would go to a final offer selector who wasn't in a position to be able to modify one or the other or add or subtract. The final selector had to take one or the other so that you had the risk of not having some arbitrator make up your what the contract would be. But, you know, if yours wasn't reasonable, it wouldn't be selected. That drove the parties closer together because they're trying to be as reasonable as possible so that their offer would be selected. In the meantime, it would probably mean that there would be an agreed-upon solution. Final offer selector would never have to work. That whole operation, that whole initiative got scuttled when another solution was introduced to the emergency disputes bill, and that was arbitration, which then everybody thought, well, you know, who's going to waste time with all these other things if 100 days later you can have somebody impose the contract and the whole effort fell apart at the time. I don't see personally how mandatory arbitration of first contracts gets anybody seriously at the bargaining table after an election. But let's start with that now. Are we going to use the same order?
Reversing order.
We're reversing.
But you go ahead if you wish.
Do you want me to go ahead?
Why don't you go ahead?
Well, I thought I was going to talk about the penalties, so if you want to go ahead, why don't you?
On the mediation?
Yeah.
One provision of the bill provides that right now, even going through a system that we view as one-sided and not really providing a fair opportunity for individuals who want to be represented by a union, even if they succeed through that process and get recognized, the union's the collective bargaining agent, in one-third of the cases, they never get a contract. And often it's because the employer refuses to bargain to a point where then there's no contract and so that the union is ultimately decertified. So the best agreements are those that the parties will come to together. And we want to help that process by providing first for mediation, and then if that's not successful, to provide for arbitration so that they will get a first contract. So that's basically what the provision provides.
Since joining Baker and McKenzie, which has been quite an experience, I am constantly going to meetings around the world and meeting with partners in different countries, and I do think the bill is misnamed. I think it should be changed to the Global Outsourcing Initiative. This is the absolute socialist influence at work here. Let's look at what's going on aside from its one-sidedness. It's almost like something off of The Sopranos. Number one, the penalties. The penalties are one-sided, and they're selected to coordinate with what we all know under board law, under 8A1, employers shall not interfere, restrain, or coerce. And it's been treated over 72 years or whatever by the 2 years by the board, looking at sort of the low-hanging fruit. Now we're going to make these penalties significant, but only against the employer. Then we're going to force first-time contracts to guarantee a base upon which to bargain subsequently. And then procedures that aren't even defined to be left to an agency that recently experimented with overtaking the board's functions and now has its senior people traveling the world giving talks about coalition bargaining and win-win bargaining way beyond its congressional mission, has no internal inspector general, and that's going to be the FMCS. This is unbelievable. Interest arbitration is used experimentally, at least in this country, only in the public sector, really, where they have no right to strike. And so it's viewed as a counter to the inability under certain states that don't permit strikes in the public sector to have some economic leverage. What does that mean? It means you go before someone my age or older, generally even older, who has no experience in the particular industry, to come in and sit down and pick. Do you want column A or column B? Baseball arbitration. There's not even a specification here. Is it going to be baseball arbitration where you take the union's total contract proposal or management's total contract proposal and pick one or the other, or is it going to be issue by issue? This is mind-boggling. This is overreaching. It's outrageous. Now, what else is wrong about this? If we're going to go that direction, I say bring it on. Let's go back and look at equalizing the penalties, and let's study some other issues. Let's go back and re-examine the Inman's decision that allows an exception to the Hobbs Act for unions. I lived through 9.5 years of a corporate organizing campaign. 54 bullets were fired, and the then Attorney General expressed no interest in even pursuing an investigation of it. You want to see the settlement agreement? It's 4 lengthy pages. Go look at it. Go look at it. We're not talking, this isn't kindergarten or fairyland. This is heavy-duty stuff. And you know what? It's all about human beings, employers and unions. People can be good or people can be bad. This is absurd. You're going to force a contract on people. Have you seen some of the contracts? Do you think it's appropriate to force, as a first-time contract, a potential outcome of multi-employer pension liability, forcing a first-time employer in this process into non-ending liability for a multi-employer pension plan that's underfunded? If you want to pick the Teamsters, pick a large number. $500 billion. Do you want to pick on someone to say, we'll have a provision like in the steel industry? Remember that industry? The one that cratered and is being reorganized now with foreign investors? Do you want to do that one? Have you looked in that contract? You want to impose this as a first contract? Union officials on the board of directors, a right of refusal on purchase of the company should it be up for sale, and a veto on any sale or merger of the entity. Do you want to have committees created and paid for on company time, crammed down not by bargaining and reaching mutual agreement, but by total impasse and crammed down on the parties? It'll work both ways. Is this what you want? Is this what it takes to get the union movement installed again?
Okay. Cheryl?
Not Cheryl. I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sarah,
no.
Oh, well, it makes more sense.
Just to talk a little bit about the penalties, as I think probably people in the room know, the penalties currently under the National Labor Relations Act for Commission of Unfair Labor Practices are the weakest of any federal statute. Unlike every other statute covering discrimination in the workplace, the civil rights statutes, for instance, which allow for consequential damages and in some cases punitive damages, the remedies provided for under the Act are so-called make-whole remedies, which means that for an employee who is discharged unlawfully for union activity, it's a back pay remedy with a mitigation requirement, which means that subtracted from the employee's back pay is any earnings that the employee had or should have had during the period prior to his offer of reinstatement. It also means that where the unlawful conduct has no monetary consequence for a particular employee, there is no monetary penalty whatsoever for the employer. So that the remedy, for example, for threatening to fire a worker for union activity, a threat which can be chilling in its effect on the employee's exercise of Section 7 rights as an actual discharge. The only penalty for that violation is that the employer may be required to post a notice in the workplace saying that he won't do it again. It's no surprise that with that kind of regime that there is essentially a culture of impunity around this, and that's part of the reason why I think unfair labor practices are as rampant as they are, and why I think, because I think when penalties for that kind of unlawful conduct are so weak. It's a sort of a statement by society, I think, that they do not consider this to be a serious violation. And I think you see that in the differing treatment of violations of the National Labor Relations Act by the public and the press. If Denny's, for example, is alleged to have engaged in race discrimination in serving the public, it's a huge public relations problem for that company, any company that is alleged to do that sort of thing considers that a public relations problem and, you know, invests huge amounts of money in trying to repair its public image. But yet employers who violate the National Labor Relations Act, it gets almost no attention. And I do think that that is in part because the penalties are so weak. What this bill would do is very modest in the back pay area. I think the average back pay award is something like $3,000. This would provide for a treble back pay remedy. And it would, for the first time, provide for civil penalties in the case of unfair labor practices that don't result in monetary damages to an employee, so that for the first time it would not be essentially something that could be done with impunity. The discretion is given to the board based on the severity of the unfair labor practice and other characteristics to fit the penalty to the appropriate circumstance. The other innovation would be not to create a one-sided penalty, but to restore an imbalance in the Act right now, which is that currently under the Act, if the General Counsel has reasonable cause to believe that a union has engaged in a secondary boycott, a violation of Section 8B of the Act, the General Counsel is required to go to the federal court to seek an injunction to immediately remedy that activity. Yet, if the General Counsel finds reasonable cause to believe that an employer has violated the Act by interfering with an employee's Section 7 rights, the Act simply says that the board may seek an injunction. As a consequence, the board seeks injunctions in just a handful of cases each year, and the numbers are just so small as to be infinitesimal and infinitesimal and significantly below where they were when Mr. Irving was the general counsel, for example. So this would restore that parity by requiring that in circumstances where an employer is alleged to have engaged in significant unfair labor practices during an organizing campaign or the period leading up to the bargaining for the first contract, that the where there was reasonable cause to believe that a violation had occurred, you would have the same parallel requirement that the general counsel was required to seek an injunction. Of course, the federal court is not it's not automatic that the court would grant the injunctions. It would continue to apply the same standards that it does now, but it would require the board to take the initiative in those cases. So.
As John mentioned, he went through a couple of problems with mandatory arbitration. I just want to touch on a couple of them again. First being that that the government here is deciding wages and benefits and not the employers or the unions. So this gives government officials unprecedented authority to set employment conditions throughout our economy. And these people are unaccountable for their actions and enslaved from their decisions. They don't have to live with the contract after it is made. You know, the great thing about collective bargaining is that the employers and the unions come and do it together, and they both know, okay, whatever the contract we come up with, we're going to have to live with this. And so it's really a preferred method, and that arbitration does not give you. Secondly, arbitration can take a really long time. There are certain arguments going around that that we want this so that we can get a contract and it'll speed things up. But if we look at Michigan as an example, they require binding arbitration for their government employees. And the typical process takes 15 months. Now, that would be on top of the 120 days of collective bargaining and mediation that that a union employer go through before they have to go to the the mandatory arbitration. So this would be a long time. It's a long time for workers to kind of be in flux as to what their, you know, raises would be, what their benefits would be, and it's a long time for employers to have to figure out what they're, you know, what they're doing and what, how much they're going to have to be paying and so forth. It's it creates a burden on both parties, and it's not optimal. And third problem with mandatory arbitration is it encourages a poor allocation of resources with businesses. Economically, this is not good policy because businesses don't know what will come out of an arbitration process. It is a total gamble, which is why it's not used very often. They don't know if it's, you know, there's no kind of line in the sand that they can draw and say, this is my final offer. We just absolutely can't go farther than this. So what happens is businesses have to prepare for the worst. They have to save money in case they have, they're going to have a high back pay award that they need to pay out, or save money in case they're going to end up with a much more expensive health care plan or so forth. This money is money that could be going to better the business and in return better both the employer and the employee. It could be going towards better marketing, new technology, more R&D, whatever it may be, but it would help the company in general, which would in return help the employer and the employee. And it's just bad economic policy for businesses not to be able to determine what is best for their business plan, because they're stuck in this long-term arbitration. Now, in regard to the penalties, this kind of goes back to my politics argument. Nowhere does this bill reveal itself more as a favor to big labor than in the penalty section, because the penalties only apply to employers, not to unions. It's basically saying we're going to have these penalties if employers do this, but it doesn't strengthen the penalties for unions. Sarah mentioned that we do have the weakest penalties within the labor law for any statute currently. Okay, let's just make them fair. Let's make them apply across the board to unions and to employers. Because if the crime is wrong, then whoever's committing the crime should get the same penalty for it. I mean, this is just kind of philosophically an odd argument not to be applying this penalty universally. Sarah also mentioned that that's a statement by society that they don't see this as a serious violation if we don't have stronger penalties. But what are we saying, by that line of thinking, we're basically saying that society is telling workers that employer coercion is not okay, but that union coercion is okay. I mean, by this line of thinking, we're saying that one type of coercion is much worse than another, which is not the case. If we're going to protect workers, if we're going to make sure that they have free choices in the workplace, then we need to make sure that they can vote without coercion, and we need to make sure that whatever contract comes out of arbitration is one that they can agree to. Right now, union workers can vote to reject certain contracts that come out of collective bargaining. They're not going to have that luxury. They're going to be stuck with this contract for 2 years. And while they're under that contract, they can't decertify the union if they're mad at the union or if they want to get out of it. This is not giving workers more choices. This is not giving workers more rights.
Thank you.
Just a couple of things. On 10J injunctions, last year the board authorized 25 10J injunctions, which were really more than the year before. And it is true that back when I was general counsel, there were considerably more, probably double that number of 10J injunctions that were authorized, but probably double the number of unfair labor practice charges that were filed, too. Just one other comment on the dynamics of arbitration. You know, if it's going to be an arbitrator that's going to solve or going to impose a contract, it seems to me human nature would indicate that both sides go to the table and stay as far apart as they can, because somebody's going to come along and split the baby. So, you know, it's better to be as far apart as possible so maybe you come out better at the end. Whereas final offer selector has kind of the opposite, where you try to get as reasonable and close so that your offer or the other person's offer is selected. But arbitration has, you know, pushes the parties further apart. Mandatory arbitration pushes them further apart rather than pull them closer together, seems to me. I mean, somebody might take issue with that, but that seems to me to be just human nature. Okay, we still have some time for questions. And let's try to focus on the remedies and on the mandatory arbitration, and if we still have time, we'll go back to the other side.
I just want to make one comment. If we're going to go down the road of penalties, aside from the obvious, which is let's see, only employers on certain things relative to such and such get penalties. But nonetheless, if we're going to go that direction, then be sure to add in on the wish list that we convert this whole process to an Article III court and remove it from an adjudicatory agency setting. That would be mandatory, in my opinion.
Can I make a comment, too, then?
Go ahead.
Well, if we're going to – we make the argument that we're only raising the penalties for one side, but the most significant change of the penalties is triple back pay. When is a union going to be liable for back pay?
I have a question. How about treble damages for unions when they violate the Beck rights of workers not to join unions, not to become full members, and not to pay for union politics? How about treble damages for that?
Well, let's try to keep this in the organizing setting, and I think that really the most significant point, other than $20,000 per violation, that can be pretty expensive, which only applies to employers. But I think the other really major change is that it makes these kind of allegations during this period of organizing or during the period of trying to obtain a first contract, to the extent that there are violations and there's reasonable cause to believe that there's been a violation, the obligation to go for an injunction is a mandatory 10L injunction rather than a discretionary 10J injunction. So, it's probably the board should get ready to probably increase its workforce by double and its resources by at least that, because in every case where there is a complaint that is authorized, generally on the basis that there's reasonable cause to believe and that there's a credibility problem, there's some reason why that can't be resolved without going to an administrative law judge to get that resolution made. So a complaint will issue. If a complaint is authorized under this setting, you go to the United States District Court in the meantime and get an injunction, and that's not one that gets authorized by the board. That's a mandatory injunction like under Section 10L, where the general counsel is obligated to go and get it. So let's talk about mandatory arbitration first. Anybody have any thoughts about that? Yes.
Yeah, I would like to hear Mr. Kennedy and Ms. Fox respond to Mr. Radabout's point, which I think is an excellent point, and that is, suppose somebody is a small business and now they have mandatory arbitration foisted upon them, and it includes that now they're bound up in some multi-employer pension plan that's probably going to end up going bankrupt. So this small employer, who never in his right mind would have agreed to that voluntarily, he might have said to the union, I'll give these people their own 401ks and I'll give them whatever pensions we can agree on, but I would never agree to go into your underfunded bankrupt pension plan. And now some government bureaucrat is going to tell this company that they have to sign on to some bankrupt pension plan. I mean, how do you justify that in the United States?
A partial answer to that, if I may, is that under those pension provisions, there is something called a free look provision, which doesn't bind an employer that hasn't been in it and wants to get in and wants to try it out for a period of time. They can join up, sign up for a free look period where they don't become liable for the underfundedness of that multi-employer fund, I believe.
Yeah, but not for 2 years, which is the required contract period.
No, but I think the free look provision is more than 1 year.
Yeah, but the statute, this proposal would require them to be bound for two.
Yeah, but I think the free look provision goes on. You can have a contract that would require the employer to be, contribute to that multi-employer fund, but they wouldn't be subject to the underfundedness problems until much beyond 2 years, I believe.
But this is only, I'd like that answered, but it's only one factor in the whole thing. I mean, how do we let a government bureaucrat run the business of some company? And the pension is one great example, but you pick any other issue you want. I mean, how does that happen? I mean, as John said, I mean, this is the United States. It's not France.
Let me to respond a little bit, and I agree with you. I think, on one level, which is that the labor movement, I think, is not generally comfortable with binding arbitration. I think there's an ideology about free collective bargaining on the union side as well. And I don't think that it is the intention of labor supporters of this bill or the hope that first contracts will end up in binding arbitration. It is viewed by labor, I think, as a remedial to deal with the same problem that the increased penalties are on the other side, which is that the penalties for bad faith bargaining are also so minimal that, first of all, it's very, very difficult to make a finding of bad faith bargaining, that it's very easy for people to go through the motions of bargaining even if they have no intent to reach an agreement, that in fact, even if someone is found to have engaged in surface bargaining, that the penalty is again a notice posting, and that this is a particularly acute problem. The current general counsel, the Republican general counsel of the board, has cited this as a problem. The statistics are very bad for the number of certifications that result in first contracts, and the feeling is that employers have learned to extend the campaign against the union beyond the point at which the union has won the election and is certified, and to continue it because they are aware that if a year goes by and the union has been unable to get a contract, the chances are very good that the employees who have already had to go through, you know, a difficult situation to get their union, and then they've gone through this period of time where there are no results, will be more likely to want to decertify the union, which they can do after the first year. So the view is, the issue is, how do you combat that? How do you combat the incentives that exist for an employer not to bargain in good faith even after the union has won an election or otherwise been recognized and certified? And the problem, this is seen as something out there that would serve as an incentive to the parties to actually bargain. And that really is the intention of it. And I think that the experience in Canada, and this is modeled after some provincial legislation that does it, the experience in Canada is, in fact, that it is very infrequently that they get to the point of binding arbitration because neither party really wants to submit to that, and that it serves as an incentive. That is ideally the goal. I, fully acknowledge that this is something that is not usual in our system, and it sort of remains to be seen how it works out.
I've got to respond to this. In the modern day of corporate campaigns, I think what you have here is a piece of legislation, as legislation generally is, not tailored to the economic variables of sectoral densities and competition and small versus medium versus large versus urban versus rural. It's a very complex issue, and we're trying to have a one size fits all. If we're going to do that, I have to go on record as well talking about the outrageous bad faith bargaining of the other side as well. I'm tired of hearing about employer bad faith bargaining. 217 days of my life to try to negotiate a contract over 8.5 years, 4 times filed 8B3 charges with the National Labor Relations Board. Never once could I get the general counsel's office then to give it attention, and yet we documented everything. We documented the days, the total number of days available over 8.5 years. We took the totality of every break in the negotiations due to union conventions and golf tournaments and so forth, the breaks due to cell phone calls, the jokes, the lack of preparation, the lack of coming to the table with proposals, on and on and on. So I want to make it clear, I'm not going to sit here and listen to issues about bad faith bargaining by employers when unions have developed a culture relative to corporate campaigns where if they can't get what they want real quick to drive the bargain to sell to get more people to join, then it gets into this never-ending ongoing battle, and the thing that I find most totally offensive about this whole discussion of bargaining is, if you're going to bargain, let's get it straight. Labor costs, wages, hours, and terms and conditions of work go to one of the four factors of the production function, for those of you who may have studied economics, okay? So let's get back down to economics. And we can buy and sell multinational corporations in less time than we can negotiate a contract for one facility, dealing with one out of four variables of the production function. We are making this a colossal, horrendous joke. And let me make it clear, I've already heard from very large clients that if you want more outsourcing, you're going to get it.
Let's just, Sarah, you mentioned that employers have a tendency to, or some of them, to string out the bargaining during the first year so that employees are more apt to seek to decertify the union. The anonymous employer would respond to that by saying that, that failure to get to a first agreement frequently is because during the organizing campaign, in order to get elected, union has made all kinds of promises to employees, which employers can't make. Unions make all these promises to employees about what's going to happen when they get to the bargaining table, and they're going to force the employer to do this and that. We're going to get you thus and so, and look down the street and hear all the things we're going to do for you. They get to the bargaining table, and the employer's answer to that is no. We're not going to do that, and they have the perfect right to take that position at the bargaining table, and the Act specifically says that it doesn't require one party or the other to reach an agreement. As a result, maybe sometimes because the employer is trying to, get to the end of the certification year, but I think also frequently it's because that is just nothing that the employer can agree to, and therefore the union is not fulfilling its campaign pledges to the workforce. The workforce gets upset with the union, and I think probably at least as often as not, it's because you get to the end of the certification year and the employees don't have what they thought they were promised, and they want to get rid of the union as a result. So it's not always that the and there are real penalties to, if the key is, or the strategy is to string out the bargaining and really engage in bad faith bargaining, there's some very serious penalties that already exist, and the new general counsel has made that one of his priorities and threatened injunctions and so forth. He's going to take a close look. That's not a situation which is really free of penalty from the employer, from the employer's side. Plus, the board has made it clear, in recent cases that it's not the employer that can come in and say, I now doubt that the union represents a majority. If the employer is going to say that and withdraw recognition, the employer has to have clear evidence, a petition, for instance, from employees saying that they no longer wish to be represented by this union. It has to be, an employer can't just go and get another election on the basis that it has a suspicion or reasonable cause to believe that the union is no longer the majority representative. The employer has to know, and has to know by some means other than instigating the petition or contributing to it himself or herself. So, there are, the agency takes a very serious look at that kind of wheel-spinning bargaining in a first-time situation.
I guess maybe my response, and again, this is not a provision that I've had experience with or I'm familiar, but I guess it would seem to me logical that then if the problem that you have is that the union is overpromising, that it would have the same effect on the threat of an arbitration remedy would have the same effect on the union as well, as to try to force them to get an agreement, because if they're being unreasonable, the arbitrator's never going to give them what they're asking for.
Yeah, I'm just not sure how the dynamics of that mandatory arbitration would work.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Be trying to get to it as quickly as possible, or would there be an incentive not to get to it?
Right.
It is beyond my comprehension how you could impose and force and expect a business enterprise that faces this thing called profits or loss, this idea of loss, how you could force and expect them to continue to operate. That's why people bargain to impasse and suffer the costs of a strike if they think they can manage through it.
But they generally don't make that claim, because then they have to show the union their books.
No. No, I'm not talking. Wait a minute. No, John. I didn't talk about that at all. What I'm talking about is they make an event. No. You've been inside the Beltway too long. We're talking about out in the middle of a country. People make an evaluation of what their perspective is on getting towards a final offer, what they project the cost to be, et cetera. And if it's not agreed to, you get impasse. And then the union has the option to strike or not. And you evaluate that. An intelligent employer, business, analyzes that. And what you've done now is you forced, through no right of impasse and that post-impasse outcome, you're forcing a contract on parties to live through it for 2 years with no right of any kind of real-world economic remedy, and people will lose. This will put some businesses out of business, and it will also force some businesses to leave the country. No question.
Dean Rutter from the Federal Society is imposing a remedy on us because we have an obligation to abandon this room. And I'd like to, I hope we didn't cut, I don't think we've cut too many questions off, but I want to thank our panel for being here today. I think we really did get to the meat of what the disagreement is here, and I appreciate all of your attention too. Everybody stayed till the end of the session, and we really appreciate that.
Can I just make one more comment about the legislation? And it's just an observation that I would make. And you know, I worked for Senator Kennedy on the Senate Labor Committee in the 90s, so I've had some experience comparing. We did the striker replacement legislation.
I neglected in your introduction to point out that you were the chief counsel, both majority and minority.
But so it's been very interesting to me, and I will just make this observation in watching the debate this time, and this is somewhat responsive to John's or to your point that this is a payoff to organized labor for political support. Something very different is going on here in the support for this legislation, and that I think because of increasing concerns about income inequality, because of increasing concerns about insecurity for working class people and the middle class, that the supporters of this bill have come to embrace it not just as a payoff to a part of their political base, and the organized labor is certainly part of the political base of the Democratic Party, but really as part of an economic program. And that is very different than what I saw in the 90s as the, you know, the calculus with which people thought about labor legislation. So I just wanted to throw that out, that there is something going on here that is quite different.
Okay, thank you very much again.